Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works, who warns that the Trump and Republicans' recently passed House budget bill will literally kill Americans by taking away health care from millions. Vietnam veteran Russell Brown, who explains why he decided to participate in the Veterans and Allies 40-day fast, demanding Israel restore full humanitarian aid to Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinian residents. And Helen Humphreys of the Connecticut Citizen Action Group, who talks about the U.S. and international campaign targeting insurance companies for their role driving the climate crisis. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On May 18th, Salvadoran police arrested prominent human rights lawyer Ruth Lopez, a fierce critic of El Salvador's right-wing president, Nayib Bukele. Lopez had represented families of Venezuelan immigrants imprisoned in El Salvador after being deported from the U.S. by the Trump regime. Lopez directs the anti-corruption unit of the Salvadoran human rights group Cristosal, which has been a vocal critic of Bukele's arrest of 85,000 mostly young men without due process under the state of emergency that Bukele declared in 2022. Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, have demanded Lopez's release. Salvadoran authorities accused Lopez of embezzlement when she worked for an electoral court a decade ago. Juanita Gobertus of Human Rights Watch said her arrest was not an isolated incident. It makes a dangerous escalation in President Bukele's effort to silence dissent. The arrest is part of an accelerating government crackdown on civil society and the free press, as Bukele is apparently emboldened by his close relationship to the Trump regime, which is paying El Salvador millions of dollars to hold deported immigrants in its prison system without due process. Peruvian courts issued a historic ruling last year granting legal personhood to the Marañón River in the Amazon basin. It was a major win for indigenous groups who rely on the river for food and drinking water, but endured 40 years of toxic oil spills from the state oil company Petroperú. Courts ordered the oil company to take action to prevent future oil spills into the river basin. The indigenous woman who led the fight against the oil company, Mari Luz Kanakiri of the Kukama people, was awarded the prestigious 2025 Goldman Prize for her environmental activism that began in 2010. Working with Peru's Legal Defense Institute, Kanakiri filed a lawsuit in 2021 seeking recognition of the legal personhood of the Marañón River to protect it from oil spills and other forms of destruction. But the Kukama's legal victory may be cut short by a new Peruvian anti-NGO law that prevents civil society organizations from taking legal action or even giving legal counsel in cases against the state over human rights abuses. Kanakiri told The Guardian the new law will cripple her battle to clean up the Marañón River, insisting the government needs to understand that it should not kill nature but protect it. Otherwise, we have no hope for our children. In early April, an emergency directive filed by Trump Department of Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins announced her plan to expand logging on federal lands by 25%. The directive would eliminate the review process ratified in the 1970 National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, overseeing federal logging contracts. A March 1st executive order by President Trump calls on the U.S. Forest Service to designate 67 million acres of federal forest land as at high or very high wildfire risk. an additional 79 million acres of forest land was classified as in a state of declining forest health. In total, Trump's executive order covers 59% of U.S. Forest Service land. The Grist noted that chopping down vast tracts of trees releases tremendous amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, exacerbating warming, which supercharges wildfire risk and causes blazes to burn faster and hotter. Anna Medema of the Sierra Club declared that the move will benefit industrial logging operations, create a negative climate feedback loop, and will be a disaster for our national forests. The Center for Biological Diversity has vowed to use every legal tool at their disposal to halt the Trump administration's implementation of this order. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
On May 22nd, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives passed Donald Trump's budget bill with just a one-vote margin. The proposed budget that now goes to the U.S. Senate slashes $700 billion from Medicaid, $500 billion from Medicare, and nearly $300 billion from the SNAP Food Assistance Program. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates that these cuts will increase the number of people without health insurance by at least 13.7 million over the next decade. The same budget that devastates millions of poor and working families increases funding for defense and border security, and most consequentially, extends Trump's 2017 tax cuts that disproportionately benefits the nation's wealthiest families. The CBO found that Trump's budget will reduce resources to the poorest 10% of Americans by 4%, while increasing household wealth to the richest 10% of Americans by the same amount. The tax cuts, projected to add over $4 trillion to the national debt over the next 10 years, caused Moody's rating service to downgrade the U.S. credit rating a week before the budget was actually passed. Your reporter spoke with Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works, who warns that if Trump and the Republicans' House budget bill is signed into law, it will literally kill many Americans by taking away health care from millions.
What they just passed is the destruction of Medicaid. It's the destruction of Medicaid. $700 billion cut from Medicaid. That's not something that the program, the system, can withstand. They can dress it up however they want. When you are talking about cuts of that magnitude, the system stops working. What does that mean? Hospitals collapsing. Rural hospitals basically gone. They're already in the middle of a massive crisis. Everywhere across this country in rural America, you're seeing hospitals closing dozens at a time across this country. And that's before this bill. That's primarily because of privatized Medicare, the reimbursement rates and so-called Medicare Advantage. But now you kick the Medicaid stool out from under these hospitals and they're gone. But don't think that it's just rural hospitals. I mean, urban hospitals are just crushed as well. And that doesn't leave suburban hospitals unscathed. The ripple effects from this will affect literally every single person in this country. When you have these hospitals closing across the country, uncompensated care costs skyrocket. Everybody's quality of care will go down. So let me be really clear. What they've done is they are killing people, primarily seniors, people with disabilities, the most vulnerable people in our society will die. They will die or be harmed because Medicaid is health care. And when people have health care, you can calculate how many of them it prevents from harm or premature death. You take that health care away and people die. That's what the Republicans have voted for. And also, it was all of the Republicans. The votes against the bill, those were all tame opposition from the right. And those votes were saying, we're not killing enough people fast enough. So that's what the Republicans voted for. Oh, by the way, that's on top of stealing food out of people's mouths with the destruction of Meals on Wheels and SNAP food assistance. And that is also on top of $500 billion in cuts to Medicare. And all of this is so they can give tax handouts to the richest people in the history of the world, like Elon Musk and his billionaire buddies. That's what the Republicans have voted for together, because that's what the Republicans believe in.
Alex, the House passed budget now goes to the U.S. Senate for debate and a vote. I wondered if you explained to our audience, your group and a wider coalition of groups around the country, what's the strategy to defeat key elements of this draconian bill that punishes the poor and working families of America while rewarding the wealthiest Americans and profitable corporations?
So I think that one of the things that we learned in fighting against some of the destructive policies against Social Security, and that's happening still, and we'll keep fighting back, but was to not overthink it that much. It was to not make things too complicated. Really get people to understand that things that they rely on, like hospitals in their neighborhoods, are at risk. So we're asking people to go to their local hospital. They can get in touch with us at socialsecurityworks.org. Go to your hospital, stand in front of your hospital. We'll help you invite elected officials. If you live in a House Republican district, that's even better. If you live in a state with a Republican senator, you know, that's fantastic. We want to make as much news as possible about the real world cost of this bill. That's what's moving people. What moves people is the real world cost, not facts and figures so much as this hospital, your hospital, is going to close. A place that you recognize is going away. And the reason it's going away is because it's being stolen from you to be given to a billionaire in the form of a giant tax handout. And we need to do as much of this as possible, as many of these events as humanly possible, showing the real world cost to people of this disaster of a Republican plan.
That was Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works. Find more analysis and commentary on the impact of the Trump Republican budget passed by the House by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Israel completed its nearly three-month blockade of all humanitarian aid into Gaza, risking widespread famine among 2.3 million Palestinian residents, growing international condemnation of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's weaponization of food and medicine pressured him to allow a trickle of aid to enter Gaza. But according to the International Rescue Committee, the aid permitted in is entirely inadequate to address the crisis where one in five Palestinians in Gaza face starvation. Chaos and Israeli gunfire erupted on May 27th as thousands of starving Palestinians rushed a food distribution site run by a newly created and controversial Israeli-U.S. aid organization called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. At least three people died and nearly 50 were injured. 2 days earlier, the group's director resigned, declaring that the operation could not fulfill its mission in a way that adhered to the principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence. The UN and other humanitarian aid organizations have rejected the Israeli-backed food distribution system. On May 22nd, a coalition of military veterans, religious, and humanitarian aid groups launched a 40-day Veterans and Allies Fast for Gaza at United Nations headquarters in New York City. The nearly 250 participants in the fast across the U.S. plan to consume less than 250 calories a day, mirroring the average daily food intake of Gaza residents. Those fasting are demanding full humanitarian aid to Gaza under UN authority and no more U.S. weapons be sent to Israel. Your reporter spoke with Vietnam veteran Russell Brown of Buffalo, New York, who talks about why he decided to participate in the 40-day fast.
Gosh, there's something about it that's so intense. How can they, you know, in the other wars, we tried to hide the atrocities. In this war, they're blatantly showing out what we're doing, you know what I mean? And they're starving, shooting children, targeting children, targeting doctors, targeting news people. It's just wiping them out, you know? And all that stuff that they're doing is, I don't know how anybody could think it's okay. And then, and on top of that, now they've, what, since March 2nd, they decided that they're going to stop shipments of food, even though there's thousands of trucks out there. And then I heard yesterday they're allowing 105 trucks, but it would take over 500 trucks a day to feed the people that, and give them the medical care that they need. You know, to me, it's a no-brainer. I mean, not that I think that that's the perfect thing, but I've been sitting around, as many of my friends have. What do we do to stop this? Because, you know, we've talked to our elected officials. We've done this. We've demonstrated. We've been here. We've gotten arrested at things. You know, we do all the different things that we've done to protest what the U.S. government's doing. If we didn't supply the weapons, the money, it wouldn't be happening. And there's another thing is where they try to conflate Zionism with anti-Semitism, you know, and it has nothing to do with each other, but it's their way of tackling anybody that comes out against what's going on. They call me an anti-Semite. But we know what's happening, and for years, many years, I have sleepless nights sometimes, periods of time when all I can think about is some wars that are going on, about the people that I was at war with, and about the people that we're at war with now, and all the injustices in the world. And I was getting better 10 or 15 years ago, you know, and able to sleep more, but then this Gaza stuff, it reminds me of everything about Vietnam, you know, and only even more so, because here they're actually trying to annihilate the people. They're trying to exterminate Palestinians. That's my view anyhow. But the interesting thing is that I've only been here in, last week sometime we started. This is day 5. Since I've been here, I don't have these nightmares. Isn't that amazing? I mean, I would wake up with horrible things about the war and stuff like that. And I guess it's because I feel like I'm doing something, you know. And it's a love and compassion for the people that are being executed and killed, you know. And I really feel a strong love and compassion for them, you know. And anyhow, I can go on. I ramble a little bit. Sorry.
No, Russell, that's very powerful what you talked about, connecting your experiences in Vietnam to the trauma that you're seeing unfold for another people in Gaza. I did want to ask you a little bit about the fast itself. As I understand it, you and the other folks who are participating in this 40-day fast are limiting the calories you take each day to about 250 calories, mirroring the average daily caloric intake for Gaza's residents. Tell us a little bit about that. I'm not sure listeners can envision what 250 calories is or isn't.
You know, I came across the thing that amazed me. I purchased a samosa. I don't know if you know what a samosa is.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
A samosa, one little samosa, it was 260 calories. So that I could, if I were to buy it during the thing, that would be my whole meal for 24 hours if I broke a piece off, you know what I mean?
Wow, that's not much.
I mean, that to me, that was a good picture. But, you know, I'm having no problem doing it because I really care about the people. I care about the issue, and I don't know that it's going to have an impact.
Russell, I did want to ask you as we conclude here, what would you like to see accomplished by this fast after 40 days pass?
I'd like to see it accomplished before the 40 days. However, the two main things to me, the first thing is that they should end the blockade and allow food and medical and you know, they should stop killing everybody. But the second thing is the U.S., their responsibility. They're in violation of major laws, criminal violations that the State Department is committing because you're not following their own laws. So I would like them to stop funding Israel. That's really important. If they stop funding Israel, they're not going to be able to do what they're doing. It's all on U.S. money. You know, I wish people would really give a hard time to their congresspeople and senators and let them know.
That was Vietnam veteran Russell Brown, one of 250 participants in the 40-day Veterans and Allies Fast for Gaza. Learn more about the famine that threatens Gaza's residents and the Veterans Fast by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Hartford, Connecticut, was known for decades as the insurance capital of the world. Its role has diminished in recent years, but it's still home to several of the largest insurance companies in the U.S., including the Hartford and Travelers. As both companies held their annual shareholders meetings in mid-May, climate activists gathered outside the two companies' headquarters, carrying banners calling on them to stop insuring fossil fuel projects. Across the U.S., pipelines, natural gas export terminals, and all other fossil fuel infrastructure can't be built until a company secures insurance coverage. The shareholders advocacy group, As You Sow, submitted a resolution to Travelers that requests the company disclose the expected impact of its climate-related pricing and coverage decisions on the sustainability of its homeowners insurance business under various climate scenarios. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Helen Humphreys, communications coordinator with the Connecticut Citizen Action Group, which organized the climate protest. Here she explains the role of insurance companies driving the climate crisis and talks about the important alliances her group is now building.
So there was a number of us that stood outside the Traveler shareholder meeting, handing out flyers to both the shareholders and a number of employees actually walk over from their office to the shareholder meeting to be able to sit in on that. And so we were handing out flyers to them, trying to explain to them that this year, As You Sow, which is a major investor in Travelers, submitted a resolution that requests them to disclose their expected impact on climate-related pricing and coverage decisions on the sustainability of its homeowners insurance business under a number of climate scenarios. Travelers fought very hard to get that off of the ballot, but the SEC did rule that the company needed to face the resolution. I don't believe that it passed, but it is an important issue that shareholders are starting to really pay attention to and get concerned about, rightfully so. And so we were outside both handing out flyers to folks about that. And then we also did have two activists that were on the inside who are also shareholders. So Tom Swan of Connecticut Citizen Action Group and Steve Simon of Third Act Connecticut both went into the meeting. They asked some questions about climate. They were the only two questions that were asked in the shareholder meeting. And I believe the way that Tom explained it was that there was a lot of distraction and deflection, and they gave kind of a roundabout non-answer that you would expect from someone who doesn't want to do those sort of things.
What is the relationship of these major insurance companies to the fossil fuel industry? Could you just sort of explain that a little bit?
I mean, when you think about climate change and fossil fuels, you know, you don't necessarily immediately think of property and casualty insurers, when in fact they're one of the most important cogs in the fossil fuel machine. Fossil fuel projects can't move forward without investments and insurance. And so if these fossil fuel projects don't get insured, they can't move forward. And so we've been looking to these property and casualty insurers to either divest from their investments or stop their underwriting policies of these fossil fuel projects, as it's completely like destroying their bottom line in terms of climate losses. They're facing billions of dollars in certain markets. And now you're seeing these property and casualty insurers pull out of entire homeowner markets, like in Florida because of the hurricanes, or in California because of the wildfires. And, you know, we're wondering how long until they have to pull out from the entire country.
Have you been able to point to any successes in terms of, you know, really shining a light on these practices and trying to get them to stop doing some of this stuff?
So actually, we just had a really great victory in the fact that Chubb Insurance, who was named one of the major insurers on a number of liquefied natural gas export project in Southwest Louisiana that they were named as an insurer and they just pulled out due to health concerns. And so we're seeing these major insurers see the risks of these LNG terminals or these coal plants or, you know, the tar sands pipelines, and they're horrible for the community health. They're horrible for the environment. There's these massive communities that are being infected by air pollution and groundwater pollution and all of that kind of stuff. And so I think there are insurers that are starting to see that this is not worth the risk, both financially and morally. And so Chubb Insurance just, you know, pulled out of this LNG project. And so now we're looking to Connecticut-based insurers like the Hartford, who has been named as a LNG terminal insurer in the South Gulf, to follow their lead and see that there are a number of insurers, both here in America and also a number of European insurers, are far beyond where American insurers are in the fact that they have started divesting and started putting their investments more in solar and wind rather than fossil fuel projects. These kind of things can sometimes feel very abstract in terms of like fossil fuels and property and casualty insurers and underwriting policies and investments, and it doesn't really tell you the real harm that this is doing to communities. And so having the folks like Rochetta Ozane, who came up to the Hartford to try and speak with the executives about the damage that these LNG terminals are doing to her community, is just incredibly more powerful than just saying divest from fossil fuels. And so you can really see just the damage and the harm and the fear in these communities for the future of their children and their grandchildren, and whether or not they're going to have really bad asthma, or they're going to have toxic drinking water, or they have to, you know, be worried about an explosion, or the workers that work in these LNG terminals. There are a number of safety concerns around these type of plants that just do real harm to the community. And so having the frontline communities at these type of, you know, rallies or having their voices heard, I think is one of the most powerful things that we can do. And so I would love to continue to, you know, amplify those stories of folks who are really hitting home with this type of issue.
That was Helen Humphreys, communications coordinator with the Connecticut Citizen Action Group. Learn more about the role of the insurance industry in driving the climate crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRWK in Midlothian, Virginia, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KVRK in Sutton, Alaska, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.